All right, so I will go very quickly through the status of the future experiments at the Cosmic Frontier. This is necessarily a sort of interim report. I don't have all the answers because we're still working on them, but I do want to give you a feeling and also invite you into the processes we've been following, where things are, and there's a lot of exciting things going on. Talk after talk after talk for Snowmass has had the P5 Venn diagram. It's amazing that at Cambridge, at Caius College, they actually put it into stained glass. He was there. He provided the theoretical framework for the last P5 report. We'll see what the next P5 comes up with. Anyway, I just want to say that it's been a pleasure working with Jonathan. All our subgroup conveners have just done a tremendous, tremendous amount of work already, I think it shows. Just to remind you, as far as the prioritization and assessment is this isn't the first time we've done it. We've done a lot of these things. We've looked toward the future quite a lot in the past already. In particular, in the Cosmic Frontier area, there was a lot of planning and prioritization work done with PASAG, which was a follow-on to P5. That was NSF and DOE, and then of course the ASTRA 2010 New World, New Horizons. There is a lot of work to do to update, fill in holes. The field moves very quickly. Lots of discoveries, lots of surprises, and so having a chance to take a look and doing it in concert with everything else in particle physics is good. Now, just to remind you about PASAG, which is now it was 2009, so it's time to have a look at it again, I guess. And since no one reads the reports, they only just look at the slides. I've shown the slides here. It covered dark matter, dark energy, cosmic particles, and CMB. It did not cover all areas of what we used to call non-accelerator physics. But again, Cosmic Frontier is marked by rapid, surprising, and exciting developments. So Joe, isn't here, had asked about what about the Cosmic Frontier and the fact that it has feet in several different areas. That's true. Some of these projects really are very much at the boundary between particle physics and astrophysics, and that is a good thing. It expands the science that can be done in lots of different areas. When it comes down to prioritization, how to spend precious resources, though, that has to be taken into account. So we developed for PASAG a set of criteria we used because we were given four budget scenarios and we had to make things fit, okay? So first of all, it was the science. Is the science necessary in the sense that does it directly address fundamental physics, but also how experiment going to be definitive, and is it just one number or is it lots of numbers? Is there a preponderance of things that the thing is going to do weighed in the sense of the science? And also a sense of what I would call relevant discovery space. If you look at the overall parameter space, you know, how far is a project going to move things forward? And that was considered by PASAG. Second is that particle physicist participation is necessary. In other words, that do we have transformative techniques and expertise to have a major and visible impact? Another test is, would the project simply not happen without particle physicists' know-how and input? Okay, and that was a second criterion. And that leadership was a higher priority than participation. And that scale matters, and this goes to the question Joe asked. You could have a project that is very broad in scientific reach. And the question is, given the costs to HEP, how much of the science, and of course you can't measure science per dollar, but you can get a feeling for it. The question is, how much of the return is going to be in the HEP area versus other areas? And that gives us sort of a sense of how much the investment from particle physics ought to be there. And if you satisfy those things, then there's absolutely no reason not to do them if you've got an overall game plan that can get the project done, and that involves programmatic issues, obviously, as well. Anyway, that's how we address it in PASAG, and I think at Snowmass we want to reopen that. and have a look at it. So PSAG, basically the simplistic, I use the word concise, but it's really simplistic summary, is that dark matter and dark energy remain extremely high priorities. Dark energy funding was the largest, the budget portion, but that should not significantly compromise U.S. leadership in dark matter because a discovery there could be imminent. And that is still true. And that those big things together shouldn't completely zero out other areas in particle astrophysics. One of the exciting possibilities and areas is, in fact, the CMB, in addition to cosmic particles, high energy, gamma rays and cosmic rays. There's also CMB measurements that are very important to particle physics, as we will, as I will show. And again, if you can meet these criteria, for the particular things we looked at in PSAG, that certainly seemed to be met. I'll come back to that. The context for the work we're doing in the cosmic frontier, we had very nice presentations at the March workshop from NSF and DOE. They even gave, one of the talks was a joint presentation, and they showed how they were following the priorities in the community and doing a lot of very interesting and exciting projects in all areas, in WIMP and non-WIMP experiments, in direct dark matter. High energy charged particles, cosmic rays and neutrinos, dark energy, CMB, and so on. And similarly, DOE and NSF, of course, have different programs. They have overlaps and synergies, but they have somewhat different perspectives. Personally, I view that as a good thing, but lots of work going on in different areas in the cosmic frontier. I think that overall it's on the scale, and Glenn can correct me, it's on the scale of about 12% of the HEP budget, something like that. Okay, we had this wonderful workshop, the so-called Woodstock. I think that Jonathan already covered all of those things. I would just say again that it was the subgroup conveners that really put this together, this incredibly vibrant, interesting program. I am still catching up on some of the parallel talks that I missed. It was very, very exciting. So the first area, Jonathan showed that we were divided into six areas, so-called CF1, Cosmic Frontier Subgroup Number 1, direct detection of WIMPs. And of course, a very simplistic picture is an interaction like this, where you have standard model particles on this side, say fermions, and on this side, WIMP dark matter particles. And of course, there's a rotation, thermal production in the early universe. Presumably, that's where the dark matter, relic dark matter was made. And of course, the thermal processes before freeze out go in these two directions. Direct detection rather follows this direction. Indirect detection goes this way, and production at colliders goes this way. And so you see that there are deep and important and complementary connections to these different approaches, and they also provide natural scales for searches, particularly for indirect detection. Thermal production doesn't have to have been thermal production, but if you say that the production was hypothesized, that it's predominantly one particle that was produced thermally, then that sets natural scales to look for experimentally. So the overall parameter space, I think everyone here is very familiar with. For the parameter space is, of course, the WIMP nucleon cross-section. This is in square centimeters, and the scale now is at the 10 to the minus 45 level, or approaching that very quickly. The so-called Generation 2 experiments aim for about an order of magnitude lower than that. At the time of PSAG, G3 was kind of an order of magnitude lower than that, and the community is really trying to expand that to make G3 a follow-up to G2 based on what is found or not. And then approximately an order of magnitude lower than that, one hits neutrino background. Development, of course, since and quite recently is the CDMS2 result, which saw three events and suggests a possibility of relatively light WIMP. That's very interesting, of course, and there's lots more to do. But this is an extremely interesting, very quickly moving area, and there's a lot of work and a lot of clever ideas. You cannot see this. This is a compendium of the different experiments that are out there, both present and future. They are collected on our web page, on the CF1 web page, by their different technologies with links to each of the different experiments. So it's there for you to grab to see what the different types of experiments can do. And they are doing a census of the different experiments, asking them in a sort of normalized way about their capabilities, backgrounds, issues, and what sort of information one can get about the character of the particle from the experiment. So that's a very useful thing that the CF1 group is doing, among many useful things that they're doing. Now, I mentioned the tough questions. There's a difference between big questions and tough questions. Big questions are questions that help us organize presentation of the science. The tough questions are the questions we ask ourselves and each other so that we can really help ourselves figure out where do we want to go, okay? And so, again, the Cosmic Frontier group generated a list of tough questions for ourselves, for the intensity frontier, and the energy frontier. We sent them all off and invited them to send us tough questions back. And I completely agree with Joanne that these tough questions, there's a fine line we have to walk, because they should be pointed, because it's important, right? And some of the discussion should be uncomfortable, but it shouldn't be, it should not be unnecessarily negative, right? We shouldn't be tearing each other down. We should be using this to build each other up. So the way we suggest is the conveners of Snowmass ought to be taking these things roughly unfiltered, send them to each other. We can then iterate on how they're written down. But Snowmass should not be completely comfortable, okay? We should be supportive, but we should be able to go in and have frank discussions, because frankly, we all have those frank discussions anyway. So we need to have a happy balance. So here are the tough questions we levied on ourselves and we got from the energy frontier. Hopefully we'll be getting from the intensity frontier soon. So first of all, with the significant change of plans involving Dussel, that was a little bit wordsmith, I'll admit, what are the needs for underground floor space for low background experiments, and are those needs met in current planning? When is the right time to abandon small projects and band together for larger ones? Should we already do that now that the DOE has spoken about its G2 plans? Dark matter detection will reach the neutrino background at some stage. What does that mean for the program planning? Suppose experiments using one target are significantly more sensitive than those using another in terms of the spin-independent cross-section. Is there compelling rationale for continuing funding experiments using the non-leading targets? And how should P5 decide? So let me just share with you my view of this, and it's just my personal view, is that Snowmass process ought to suggest, ought to pose and answer these tough questions. And then it's P5's job to judge the answers, along with the community. Okay, we don't have a mandate to prioritize, but what we can do is answer the tough questions, and P5 can take that as input. If we as a community throw at P5 hundreds of great ideas for projects and say it's all really great and it's a, you know, sort of a kumbaya thing, P5 is not going to know what to do with it. Okay, they are going to have to deal with tough questions because they're just as unitary in the funding. All right, so the second, CF2, indirect detection. Now here it relies on interactions. Typically it's annihilation, so it goes like the square of the density of the dark matter, or it's decays, which goes like the density of the dark matter, and we don't know the details. We have some good ideas about where the dark matter is. There are lots and lots of places to look astrophysically for indirect detection signatures. This is just for gamma rays, for example. And of course, the real sky in gamma rays looks a little bit different. So it's astrophysics on top of the dark matter interactions, and so one has to tease these things apart. For gamma rays, these two WIMP particles meet. They annihilate to standard model particles, which have various cascades and other interactions, making gamma rays, and also makes neutrinos. And that's really important and really interesting. I'll get to that in a minute. And then, of course, there are two-body final states, which can make lines. Now, how do you take all that and search for limits? Well, the overall flux can be factorized into an astrophysical factor, which is just the line of sight integral over the square of the dark matter density. And for that, you pick a particular model and state your assumptions. And then there's a particle physics factor involving branching fractions, the WIMP mass, and the velocity average cross section. So what we do typically is we report this as a function of this for assumptions about the branching fraction and density. And typically it's 100% branching fraction. You just do it for the different species and that shows you where you get. And this is where things stand. The Fermi results, non-detections from dwarf spheroidals, which are very dark matter rich objects nearby the Milky Way. And this natural scale is the velocity average cross section that you need, about 3 × 10⁻²⁶ centimeter cubed per second, to produce the right amount of dark matter thermally. And but looking this way for neutrinos, even with the incomplete ice cube array, also is an interesting and competitive way to do that. And future TEV experiments are going to really come down here, as I'll show in just a minute. There's another way in which neutrinos give us great information, possibly, and that is that the WIMPs once in a while interact with the sun, which is a big ball of hydrogen. And if it loses a little bit of energy in that scatter, it'll be gravitationally trapped. It'll continue to scatter, lose energy, and thermally find its way to the core of the sun, where there'll be annihilations, and the signal is to look for high energy neutrinos from the sun. This also works for the Earth. It's a little closer, lower mass, and so on. But what's great about that is that a lot of the uncertainties about the spin-dependent cross-section either go away or are easier to understand. And in fact, they get really the best results on the spin-dependent cross-section just by looking at the core of the sun, and that will continue to get better. There's an idea to fill in the array toward the core called Pingu, and I'll talk about that. That will also help push this to a lower energy. So indirect detection of facilities are also summarized here, both current and planned experiments, where they are funded mainly, what the type is, and so on. And again, this is an area that crosses boundaries, and so they are things that are both have challenges and opportunities associated with them. So the key findings of the so-called CF2, they say that CTA with US enhancement would provide a powerful new tool for searching for WIMP dark matter. So you can see the same velocity average cross-section as a function of mass. And now you see for example, and taus and bees are very optimistic cases for looking for gamma rays, but you see that they go to very high mass out to a relatively a very low cross-section. The future neutrino experiments like Pingu, which is mentioned here, which is again an infill array for ice cube, could help look for high energy neutrinos from the sun for dark matter annihilations. They can also, they think, say things about neutrino oscillation parameters and possibly even say something about the hierarchy having to do with the MSW interactions in the Earth. So those are good opportunities. So tough question for indirect detection. Given a large and unknown astrophysics uncertainties, for example, when observing the galactic center, which has really been quite challenging. What is the strategy to make progress in an experiment like CTA, which is new territory as far as backgrounds go? How can we believe the limit projections until we have a better indication for backgrounds, and how far does Fermi data go in terms of suggesting them? And what would it take to convince ourselves that we have a discovery of dark matter? Okay, non-WIMPs, that's CF3, that's a lot. Okay, it's like saying non-accelerator physics. There's a lot of science, both theory for all these areas. And here's a summary slides from Alex and Leslie from the March workshop. And there was this snow dark meeting. There's a lot going on. And of course, axions as dark matter, very attractive. I won't have arguments from at least several people in the room. The constraints now and different models of how the dark matter, where would be the right range to look as far as motivations related to dark matter. ADMX is expected to be able to fill in essentially all of that space, and that's a very exciting possibility. So tough questions for CF3. Clarify the uncertainties in the expected axion detection rates. So for particle physics, on the particle physics side, for a given mass, what's the lowest possible coupling? If there's no lower bound, are there values beyond which the models get qualitatively more fine-tuned and the search becomes less motivated? In astrophysics, can there be large variations in the local density? Just how is this, how is the condensate actually distributed is something that is apparently very widely debated. And what is the target range for axion mass and coupling, and how's that justified? That's being revised as a question. CF4, Jonathan mentioned the dark matter complementarity. So there were two ways in which this document went at this, and it showed, this was requested by the agencies. It was one of our deliverables. It's there, it's on the archive. I recommend you have a look at it. It's why do we need to look for dark matter in all these different ways? What do all these things bring? And they approached it in two ways, theoretically. One is by looking at four particle contact interactions, the operator, effective operator approach. Whether they primarily interact with gluons, quarks, and leptons, and the best sensitivity, the border here has to do with providing the right density of dark matter. And in those different situations, you get different leading ways in which to probe to get the first evidence for dark matter. So that shows it very nicely. And in addition, using an MSSM scan, you can divide up the plane into ways in which you can see these things either through direct detection, indirect detection, or both. That's the red area. And also a region that may be found with the LHC upgrade and no other way. Those are the gray points. So that's there's an awful lot in these plots, and I can't really go into it in detail, but I urge you to have a look at that document and also send comments, because I think this is something that can be iterated and is a very valuable thing, I think, for the agencies. But another way to look at all this is here, which is that all these things really do play together. They all really are important, and I'll come back to that. Okay, so tough questions for dark matter complementarity. What would it take to convince ourselves that we have a discovery of dark matter, that we've discovered two different species of dark matter, discovered all of the dark matter, and also a false signal of dark matter? I mean, after all, if an experiment is claiming a discovery, which has happened, right, there's the Dahma result, what's it going to take? What's it going to take for us to say yes or no? Okay, how do we do that? So that's a tough question. If dark matter is detected through non-collider experiments, what could we learn about its properties? Would we be able to learn whether it interacts with standard model only through the Higgs portal? Suppose there's a 10 GeV WIMP or 100 GeV WIMP with direct detection cross-section just below the current limits. What's the full set of measurements that we are likely to make on such a particle from cosmic frontier probes alone? If there's more than one type of dark matter particle, how can we discover this in cosmic frontier experiments? Can we measure the dark matter fraction from different sources? In indirect detection, it's notoriously difficult to rule out the hypothesis of astrophysical origin. We kind of saw that already. But how can knowledge from particle physics in other measurements help? For example, would it be helpful to know the mass of the dark matter candidate? The answer is yes. And what accuracy is needed? Can direct detection provide sufficient accuracy? If the dark matter has no standard model interaction stronger than gravitational, are there any prospects for discovering its particle nature? Ouija boards are not allowed. Okay, so cosmic surveys and particle physics. So Scott Dodelson gave a very nice talk at the Intensity Frontier workshop. I think several of you were there. And it's a really interesting thing that going from the CMB to the large-scale structure that we see today, there's an overall story that's driven completely by beyond the standard model particle physics. Okay, so first of all, inflation at very early times shapes the CMB map, that seeds the structure formation that's driven by dark matter that produces the growth of structure that we see today, which is then driven by dark energy. Great, nice story, except that we don't really have a clue about any of these things. So you want to know, is there physics beyond the standard model? Yes, absolutely yes. Okay, We have to understand this, okay? It's absolutely huge, core, and extremely interesting, and also extremely promising. Okay, inflation, one worried about because nature doesn't use scalars, obviously, but now we know it does. It's really great. Okay, and so there's a lot here that's all physics beyond the standard model, and detailed comparisons of these different observations are going to provide lots of surprises, and along the way we get to find out about neutrinos. So dark energy facilities, this was from both Michael Turner and Klaus Hahnschild at the summary. Klaus showed the summary slides of the different dark energy experiments that are current and planned. And again, it's the synergy of these different waves, because we're really getting beyond what exactly is W and W prime, but also, are these things self-consistent? Are there ways in which our framework is just wrong? That's what's really exciting about using these different approaches. But also CMB tells us a tremendous amount just by looking, for example, at the so-called damping tail, at the high L values where the acoustic peaks are damped, where they're going down. There's a good, you know, pretty reliable, understandable calculation of what that ought to be, and you compare that with observations, and you're going to see what happens to the CMB on the way to us. Okay, there are lots of different effects that are actually sensitive to things like number of light neutrinos, and also the sum of the neutrino masses. And there are also other effects, okay? This is an extremely beautiful paper, actually, Hu et al., that I gave the archive number is there. And that's incredibly exciting. And these guys have big plans, again, stage two, stage three, and stage four. One can get at both through lensing, be able to get at neutrino properties, and also, very, very importantly, the imprint on the CMB polarization from different, that would be posited by different models of inflation, is incredibly difficult and also incredibly exciting. And so the ability to be able to look at all these different epochs and how they connect together is really an important thing that will add a tremendous amount directly to beyond the standard model of particle physics. So, tough questions. What are the roles of optical and CMB observations for particle physics? What are the intrinsic uncertainties in supernovae that limit extractions of the properties of dark energy? I think that can fairly be asked of all the different techniques. Dark energy experiments are proposed. Suppose that we find W is minus 1 at stage 4 sensitivity. What are the motivations to do any more? And is there a value at which improved precision becomes drastically more difficult to obtain? I think the answer is yes. And again, there was a question, actually, I think this was an energy frontier question. How do we move forward, or how well can we rely on the information about the light degrees of freedom from CMB? What are the prospects for establishing that this number is indeed greater than 3, alternatively providing upper bound well below 4? By the way, there are even ideas to be able to get at the hierarchy using this information. So it's really a very interesting area. So let's see, CF6, so this is really everything else in the cosmic frontier. The summary here, the universe will tell us a lot if we know how to listen, but the encoding can be both complicated, and there's multiplexing. In other words, there are a lot of backgrounds and other information that have to be sorted out. A lot of information carried by neutrinos, gamma rays, and cosmic rays. Very similar, looking possibly at getting information about the hierarchy, probing physics at the Planck scale, or at least looking for violations of Lorentz invariance. There's already good information for Fermi on that, for example. Probing for extra dimensions, and looking at interactions at very high energy, and there are ideas for new instruments that are here. Most of these instruments are mainly funded actually outside of particle physics. Okay, 1 minute left. Tough questions. What will it take to identify the mechanism of baryogenesis or leptogenesis? Are there scenarios that could conceivably be considered to be established by experimental data in the next 20 years? What experiments are required to achieve this? What are the leading prospects for detecting the GCK neutrinos, and what are the roles of cosmic ray gamma ray and neutrino experiments for particle physics? What future experiments are needed in these areas and why? Are there areas in which these can have a unique impact? Okay, and a CF, cosmic frontier-wide question, which is what criteria could be used to prioritize activities across the cosmic frontier, all these different areas, given limited budget, how do we do that? I just want to say that technology, of course, drives all of these discoveries. I'll be done in just a minute. And I can't resist just showing two or three slides from Juana Schrader's talk just as an example. MKIDs that are actually give information about the energy of each photon, for example, optical photon, and also silicon photo. Multipliers are very, very promising for making really great measurements, and you have to be careful when you're a theorist. When you say something nice about experiments and technology, someone will grab it and say this. I think it wouldn't hurt for some experimentalists, some of us, to say the same thing about theory, particularly given the state of theory funding. So I think all these things really need to connect together to do great projects. Without theory, it's a real problem. So just to sum up, this I made a little collage for the October meeting, all the activities going on, and a lot of them are already out of date. There's new information here. There are 28 high energy events from Ice Cube. Lots of stuff is moving forward. So a big message, I think, is that together with the other frontier areas, the cosmic frontier is an important part of the story for strengthening support for high energy physics, okay? So it's not like one area trying to get more of the pie from another area. It's really that all together we can help to make the case for particle physics. Clearly the pieces the cosmic frontier brings is that there's clear evidence for beyond the standard model physics. There are lots of surprises. There are profound questions of popular interest. Frequent new results with broad impacts, a large discovery space, and a full range of project scales, which programmatically is extremely important when Jim Segrest suddenly has an opportunity to fund something. Being able to have something that's of small scale that can go quickly is extremely useful. So I am not suggesting that we all take our clothes off and dance together, but I think that this is an important part. This maybe puts into pictures what Hari was saying before, and I strongly support that. And just to close, a little ad, don't forget the DPF meeting in Santa Cruz. Thanks.
Thanks, Steve. So now we have time for questions.
Eva. No, Bob. Eva had her hand up right in front of you. You have two mics? I have two ears? No.
Sorry, this is just a short comment that I want to reinforce something you said, which is with the CMB, a particular aspect of it that you had on your slide was the B-mode measurements, and those are incredibly interesting. They give an opportunity to, for the first time, measure the variance of the gravitational tensor field, and we'll reach a threshold in inflationary theory corresponding to the Planck range in field space. And that is incredibly ultraviolet sensitive and interesting. It's not just a fishing expedition. Either a detection or a null result at that level is extremely important. So I hope that, you know, funding for B-mode experiments doesn't fall through the cracks of the agencies, et cetera. And as part of this process, some of us are writing up a letter to send around to particle physicists, hoping that people will sign on to this as interesting science. So that's all I wanted to say. Thanks.
I'll just say what we found in PA SAG was very small investments at the scale of a few million dollars, and letting the labs just participate in what they do best, integrating large scale numbers of detectors, was going to be the crucial thing that put the whole thing together. I'm not hearing anybody propose a grand, big, very expensive endeavor. That may happen, I don't know, but that so far I haven't heard that. So it's not, you know, there are very small things one can do that have an enormous impact, and I think that's the message. Bob.
Yeah, Steve. In your review of the tough questions with respect to the WW prime space and dark energy investigations, you talked about, you know, a barrier that you might run into because of technology, techniques, instrumentation. But in terms of a figure of merit, it's an area in this plane.
Yeah.
So what about a theoretical motivation for, you know, what's the right area for that FOM. You know, it's an FOM that's easy to understand, but in terms of the theory, is there, you know, some area of that FOM that's somehow relevant, that's the appropriate target?
Well, Lars, would you guys accept as a deliverable from this meeting a theory of dark energy, or is that a little too much? Oh, okay. Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think it's the kind of thing which you do what you can, and along the way you get to do a huge amount of great science. And I think, you know, after stage four, there's some head scratching. Either there's a theoretical breakthrough and there's something different from expectation, or all the other three combinations of those, and then one has to figure out what to do. I agree with that. Yeah. So that's why the question was there. And I think the problem is we don't have theoretical guidance. And this is what happens when we don't.
I mean, dark energy is part of the standard model. In the standard model,
Okay, yes.
Or any variant that we've ever come up with, it's a free parameter.
Yes, okay.
And it's a great prediction that E equals minus rho, you know, pressure equals.
Yeah.
That's a deep consequence of a basic symmetry of general relativity. It's the only form of pressure and energy that looks the same for all observers. So it's a great prediction of the standard model. And it's a little dishonest, I think, to say that dark energy is an indication of physics beyond the standard model. It's a deep prediction of the standard model of general relativity plus everything else we know about fundamental physics. It's great to test it in many places, but testing it is a test of the standard model. So one of those tough questions should be, how much are we willing to spend and prioritize to make fundamental null tests of general relativity in our program? There are other ways of testing general relativity, by the way, which would be equally expensive.
Okay, that's a good impact. One thing that makes me nervous is if we were all wise sitting in a room and somebody came to us 15, 20 years ago and said, I want to use supernovae to measure the expansion history of the universe. I'm not sure how many wise people would say, yes, that was a good thing to do.
The history is a little different. People have been trying to measure the cosmological constant since 1920 in many different ways. I know quite a few ex-colleagues at Princeton who didn't get tenure because they unsuccessfully tried to look for the cosmological constant. It's, you know, for some
Princeton?
Of the particle
the
physics
Jersey?
People,
yeah, okay.
It might have been a bit of a surprise. But.
Okay, just a quick comment, and actually this is echoing something a colleague of mine, Raphael Lang, had said a little while ago, which is, one of the things about the cosmic frontier is that a lot of the relevant experiments, when we're starting to think about what we present as worth funding or not worth funding, or when we have to make those tough decisions, one of the things to keep in mind is that a lot of the experiments in the cosmic frontier that really can make a lot of headway are relatively cheap. This is true, and it's also true as far as a lot of the simulation activities. There's
yes.
been a lot of progress in many-body simulations
yes.
as well over the past few years, and these are all inexpensive. So we should kind of keep that perspective in mind when talking about the tough decisions we have to make. These are cheap experiments, and there's a lot of bang for the buck.
Yes, I certainly want to second the point about simulations. It's been incredibly important. I agree.
So I just had a suggestion or a question about this measuring neutrino properties with the CMB, which seems like a relatively new idea, and it's certainly an exciting idea. But you could also turn this around and say, since we're planning on measuring those properties other ways, this could be useful for other things we want to extract out of the CMB, because here's a relatively small component of the CMB. You extract it, you compare it with what you get some other way, it gives you confidence that you actually know how to do precision CMB physics for more exotic things.
So Steve, the canonical WIMP mass versus WIMP cross-section plot you showed on page 7?
Direct or indirect? Direct. Yeah.
I think it was direct.
Yeah.
So using similar effective field theory operators, there are ways of projecting the missing transverse energy signatures from colliders onto the same plot.
Yes.
That might be a great example of how snow mass pulls the different frontiers together.
Wait, say again, I'm sorry. You're saying...
Page 7 or 6?
No, it's, yeah. It's
this one, you just flashed it.
Yeah, no, it's here. You mean this?
WIMP mass versus WIMP cross-section.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, sorry about that. The slides are online. They're in the. Yeah, and they look good online.
The collider signatures of missing transverse energy can be projected on that same plot.
Yeah,
there's a very nice complementarity in that light WIMPs are easier to make at colliders than heavy ones, and so that might be nicely complementary to how the low energy experiments work. And so that could be a very nice way.
I'm not sure if that didn't happen here. Actually, I'm not. Okay. Yeah. Let me. If Jonathan's on the phone, he can. Is Constantine?
I'm here. So yeah, this is precisely what's demonstrated on this plot. So you can see on the left side at low masses, colliders provide the best limit.
Exactly.
So if you look at the red line, that's all coming from the LHC searches for monojets. It's already accounted in that.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this is a different y-axis.
Yes, this is a factor called R that's not yet explained in the document, but will be, times the spin. It's the spin independent cross section, right, Constantine? It's your plot. You should say.
So first, we have to look at the upper plot. So the upper plots are all parametrized in terms of the annihilation cross section because it's basically a one parameter model. So you can parametrize in terms of anything. So in this particular case, we chose annihilation cross-section because that's directly related to the physics rather than some lambda high scale that is not a measure.
Is it also a reason you're dominated by gray here at lower masses, or is that not the case? These are not particularly light, though.
Many of these give a Rayleigh density which is too low, and that penalizes the signals. So it's here in the lower plots, it's not required that the Rayleigh density is provided 100% by the SUSY ones. It could be a small fraction.
And one has to be careful. This R factor is defined so that you get the right Rayleigh density. Omega is 0.23, right?
Can I make that plot? Let me say that.
Oh, okay, beautiful. So very good.
Right. So this is showing complementarity of direct detection and indirect detection, right? So everything green and red is going to be seen by direct detection in the next few years. Right, okay, sorry. So x-axis is the WIMP mass. The y-axis is the spin-independent cross-section scaled by a factor, which is how much of the dark matter the LSP makes up. So we're agnostic about, if the dark matter, if the LSP makes up half the WMAP measurement, then we scale this cross-section down by a half. So the green points are going to be seen by direct detection in the next few years, and this means xeon 1 ton plus coupe 500. The blue points are going to be seen by in future indirect detection experiments, meaning mostly CTA with a US contribution. The red points are seen by both, and sort of the gray points are seen by neither, and you'll see a version of this plot in a couple days where some of the gray points are colored a different color when the LHC can see them. And one nice thing that you can't see because I haven't colored those gray points on this version is that CTA is really good at getting those points with heavy WIMPs, which, of course, like was mentioned, is harder for a collider to produce. So that's all I want to say about that plot.
Okay.
Sorry. So this is a scan of the PSM. So R parity conservation, no CP violations.
It doesn't say P in the document.
The P is not there.
I agree. Yeah.
Okay.
I just tried to read the document.
We have to move on here. So
I'm going to try to move to
do
here.
Let's thank the speaker again.